Welcome to Dragons, Gazelles, and Unicorns, a podcast that brings to life breakthroughs in commercialization, economic impact, and world dynamics. I'm Rosemary Truman, founder and CEO of the Center for Advanced Innovation, and today we have a very special guest speaker, Nick D'Onofrio. Nick was 45 years with IBM, leading strategy and innovation. I've had the distinct pleasure and privilege of knowing and being friends with Nick for over 25 years, having had the opportunity to participate in two significant transformations at IBM. Nick has served or is serving on many boards as well, Bank of New York Mellon, Liberty Mutual, AMD, Aptiv, MITRE, the National Association of Corporate Directors, Peace Tech Labs, and many, many more. I could spend half this podcast talking about Nick's amazing career, but I'm mostly honored that he's the chairman of my board. So Nick, thank you so much for taking some time to be on my podcast today.
It's my pleasure, Rosemary. Thanks for having me.
I know you're going to provide some extremely valuable insights for the audience. So could you start by talking about your career and how you got to where you are?
Oh boy, there's not enough time for all of that, especially given I'm 75 years old. But how did it all happen, I guess, is the right maybe framing for this. So I was born and raised in Beacon, New York. I'm a second generation American. My mom and dad were born here. My grandparents were all born in Southern Italy. Beacon, New York happens to be in the Mid-Hudson Valley. That's IBM territory, or it was very popular IBM territory at that point in time. And back in 1962, when I was still in high school, it became obvious to me, electricity was important, was becoming more and more important, and I wanted to be involved in it. Wasn't very good mechanically, my dad was, but I actually had a pretty good understanding of what was going on. So through a lot of special training by my mom and my dad, both who are passed now, they raised a pretty good son. And that son went to RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, to get his electrical engineering degree. And that son also won a competitive co-op assignment with IBM, which helped me pay for my college years because my parents were quite very poor. I had an older brother, two younger sisters. And I went to IBM, not only because it was close at home and I could save money, but my mother continuously pushed me to go to IBM. No one in our family was really there. And she, being the mother that she is, always wanted to talk about her kids and, you know, my son, the engineer, my son, whatever. So I went to IBM. Didn't think I was going to go back to IBM after my co-oping experience, after I graduated from RPI. So I started with IBM in 64. I thought I would go west. My mother thought otherwise and convinced me to stay right where I was. Wanted to marry my high school sweetheart. So I stayed. I went to IBM on a full-time basis in 1967. And I stayed there. As you know, Rosemary, through the good and the bad, we met during the bad, as you helped us reboot ourselves back in the early 90s. And then, you know, I graduated from IBM in 2008 with a lot of wonderful memories and hopefully, you know, a lot of good things done as the Executive Vice President for Innovation and Technology. And then I began, you know, I just moved on. I graduated, moved on, and took on a whole bunch of other roles, which we can certainly talk about. But how did it begin? I think it began because my father pushed me to be better than him, to change. And then my mother nurtured me to allow me to do that.
Well, you know, we have a lot in common, Nick. You know, well, I think
I know that. Believe me, I do know that.
But you didn't talk about what your newspaper route.
I won a Gannett Newsboy scholarship. I mean, sadly, it was boys at that point in time, only boys. You know, 4 years delivering papers 6 days a week, including Saturday after school, then Saturday, about 100 papers in the route. Didn't make a lot of money doing that. But I won the Gannett Newsboy scholarship, and that's what helped me get started at RPI, a couple of other scholarships that I won, and then the IBM co-op job I mean, I was so fortunate, Rosemary. Think about it. 1967, come from a poor family. You know, we got six people in our family. My dad doesn't even make $8,000 a year as a guard for the New York State Penal Institution. And I graduated debt free.
Is that awesome?
It is awesome when you think about it and you reflect on it. And like, you know, it's a little bit like when there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah, that's right.
But also, just to be candid with you, I was fortunate, you know, to find opportunity. A lot of talent isn't fortunate in finding opportunity. And maybe that's something else we want to talk about a little bit later. But I consider that a gift and just a great turn of fate for me.
Well, I'll just mention to the audience that we both grew up really poor and we're had Italian ancestry. And pushy moms. My mom's rule was you go to Ivy League school and get a full scholarship. And we just didn't disagree. We just didn't disobey her. I mean, she just had a
right. No, you didn't disobey. No, that was a good idea. Or my father, in my case, but you really didn't mess with him.
Oh, okay.
He ruled. Oh, by the way, I'm writing my book, as you know, Rosemary, and my book hopefully will be out early next year. Has a lot of this, you know, in it. You know, it's meant to be more of a teaching book, you know, kind of connecting my, I like to say it, there's three eras in my life. You know, my mom and dad raised a very good son. I'd like to believe that. My wife has raised an even better husband, but my children have raised a super dad.
Oh, that's awesome. I love it. Can you tell the audience what your book is called, or is that a secret?
No, it's not a secret. The operating title right now, working title, whatever you want to call it, is If Nothing Changes, Nothing Changes.
Love it.
And there's a whole story behind that that you'll get to read. That's really my father. That's my, it describes my father's relationship with me.
Oh, wow. So, since we were talking about it just now, I mean, you said you were fortunate to find opportunity. Mm-hmm. How did you go about doing that? I remember I was just, it was difficult to find opportunity when I was young too. I mean, I just went to the library and looked at every possible grant or, right. You know, award that I could win and, you know, anything else. But how did
So Rosemary, I guess a lot of it is fate. I mean, I'm not that, I'm a somewhat religious person, but I'm not, you know, a holy person or anything like that. But I think some of it's fate. I mean, being in the right place at the right time, making the right decision. I made my decision very early on, Rosemary, to be an electrical engineer. I actually made that decision my freshman year in high school. I remember having to write the citizenship ed paper, like, what are you going to be when you grow up? And so I did all the research. My father had a friend who worked for the New York Central Railroad. They were electrifying the New York Central Railroad at the time. So he was an electrical engineer. He happened to graduate from RPI. And my father was not a well-educated man. My mom was very smart. She got through, she was born in New York City. She got through, I forget which high school it was in the Bronx. She got through it by the time she was 16. She graduated at 16. My father never even got out of the 10th grade. He quit for family reasons. His mom had another baby and died. So he went off to work to help his father, who barely spoke English. I believe my intersecting with my father's one college-educated friend, you know, okay, how'd that work? That's just one degree of freedom that you get plugged into. And he happens to hit on exactly what my mind goes crazy about, like, wow, you're right. All this stuff is going to continue to grow. Everything's going to become electrified. Everything is going to be depending upon electricity. I like that, you know, and since I'm not that good with my hands, I mean, everything my father gives me to fix, I break, you know, maybe this is a good idea for me. And then he happens to go to RPI. I apply to RPI for early decision. I work the news route, you know, hard, make a little bit of money, worked a lot of jobs though, Rosemary. My dad worked us very hard. You know, not only do we have to take care of the property, you know, the house we lived in, my news route, I had to work in a gas station on the weekends. My father painted houses, you know, in his spare time. We painted houses with him. So, you know, hard work was kind of built into it. And everywhere along the way, I'm trying to figure out, like, okay, what's the angle here? You know, how do I break out of this? How do I find some other way to do this? The RPI thing, I mean, we were going to be in debt, to be honest with you. I mean, even with the Newsboy Scholarship, New York Region Scholarship, and a couple of other little scholarships, we were definitely going to be in debt. If I hadn't won the IBM co-op assignment, we would have just been miserable. It would have been just a very tough time for me and for my brother and my two younger sisters. But I luck out, competitive, class of 1,000, only 100 co-op assignments. I get one. You know, I nail it. I nailed my first semester. I nailed my interview. And I got to work in the Mid-Hudson Valley for the next 3 years, right? And I made reasonable money because I lived at home. I could save everything I was making from IBM. All went to RPI, you know, either pay for room or board. I worked while I was at RPI. I was, we called them proctors then. I mean, dorm counselors, whatever you want to call them now, you know, and that paid for my room and board my senior year. So, you know, it was fortuitous, I guess, is the best way for me to say it, Rosemarie, right? Like some people say there is no luck, right? That you make your own luck, that hard work makes luck, or you take advantage of situations. Maybe that's what I did. Take advantage of situations. But I am an engineer. I think like an engineer. I'm a problem solver. You know, I'm quite analytical. And I look at things a little differently, and I only solve problems that I can solve, right? I mean, I gave up trying to solve problems I can't solve a long time ago. I'll keep looking at a problem, and you know this from our time together at IBM. I'll keep looking at a problem until I can figure out the problem to solve. That makes sense to you?
It makes sense. It makes sense. I remember my senior year of college, and I really wanted to do this thesis on why do women choose lower wages? And I wanted to do my thesis with this guy who wrote a book on the wage gap. And he was only going to be there for the first semester. So of course, I begged him to do a one semester thesis. Right. And which got the Samuel Bowles Prize. But I knew that Samuel Bowles Prize was there, and it hadn't been given out for 13 years. And it's about identifying opportunity and going after it. Yeah. So I think that we also share that in common. I love your stories. They're fantastic.
Thank you.
So after you got done with IBM, let me just take that back. You know, during the course of IBM and the course of IBM, what are some of the highlights that you have?
Yeah, my view of IBM is a lot different than what you see today. You have to remember, I started with IBM in 1964 was the first year I worked for them when they announced the System 360. Mr. Watson Jr. was the CEO. The only other CEO they had was Mr. Watson Sr., who was still alive, but, you know, not well. Right from the beginning, Rosemarie, it was a thrill a minute. I mean, everything was changing at such a fast pace. And that's another very important point, especially for innovators, right? I mean, it's the rate of change, It's the acceleration, not just velocity. You know, you look at the gradient and then you see, is that gradient changing? Everything was accelerating. I mean, so I started out in technologies would boggle your mind. You don't even remember these things, like vacuum tubes, ferrite cores. I mean, that's how computers were made at those times. I was an ace at ferrite cores, ferrite core memory design. I learned that in my co-op experience. I actually designed circuits. Eventually, those vacuum tube circuits became bipolar circuits. That's just a kind of technology to make integrated circuits with. And then when I finally went to work for IBM full time, we were facing off, you know, do we move to this thing called an FET versus a bipolar? They're two different kinds of technologies. They're both semiconductors. I got to be in the middle of that primordial ooze. You know, I like to think of it as the primordial ooze. Like, you don't know what's going to come out of it, but something's going to come out of it. And, you know, I'm just an average intelligent person. I mean, I don't have a big brain or anything like that. I mean, maybe a 3.3 at RPI. You know, I just a regular kind of a person, think hard, think like an engineer. I'm in the middle of this and I'm doing things, Rosemary, that frightened the living tar out of me. Like, do I actually know what I'm doing here? No one is here to check me because nobody else knows what I'm doing. Nobody else knows. And I'm saying to myself, God, I hope I got this right. I'm laying out these chips on my kitchen table. You know, I mean, I'm doing all this work, but pretty much by myself. I have some computer programs to help me, you know, do some simulation. Again, we're talking about, you know, the mid to late 60s, and they all work, right? I mean, the chips I design in bipolar work, the chips I design in FET work. FET becomes CMOS. Most people understand it that way now. So that early formative phase of my life, I'm very proud of it because of the high gradient, the high rate of change, and the rate of change that I got through it. Not only got through it, I thrived on it, to be honest with you. I kind of made my reputation as a pretty good problem solver, very clever, very innovative, 7 patents to my name, you know, very early on in my career with IBM, very, very early on. You know, and then later, you know, you move into the leadership phase where you're going to be leading people. You're not going to be doing things. So come 1970, 71, I'm through doing meaningful work. You know, I've done all the real work I'm going to do. Now I'm going to lead other people to do real work. You know, go to Burlington, Vermont. That's where the memory mission moved. You know, manage that team, grew to be known as a problem solver, fix the problems in Burlington, you know, their technology's wrong, bring CMOS to the IBM company. I'm very proud of that. I was there. I didn't do it, but I was the leader for bringing the CMOS technology to the IBM company. Move to the PC company. It's all screwed up. Go fix it. Fix what? I mean, everything's broken. I mean, how much stuff can I fix in one day? You know, like we got OS2 versus Windows. We've got the ESA bus versus the microchannel. You know, we got 3.5 inch disc versus 5.25 inch disc. I mean, it's, you don't remember that era. I'm sure it's too, well, you might remember it when we brought out the, you know, PS2 and OS2. I mean, it was like, oh my God, this thing doesn't make any sense in the market. Go fix that. Then go to Austin. We don't have a workstation. We invented the chip. We invented the RISC technology. We have no product, Nick. Go get that fixed. Go to Austin. 3 years later, we announce, release, so ship, support the RS6000. We turned it into a $1 billion business in 6 months.
Wow.
Unix, AIX is on the platform. That's the IBM version of Unix. By the way, you did such a great job, Nick. Go to Poughkeepsie, fix the mainframe because that thing's all screwed up. So here I am, I'm back home, right? I'm born and raised in Beacon, New York. Poughkeepsie is just like 10 miles north of Beacon, maybe 15 miles north of Beacon. My mother's thrilled. I'm upset, to be honest with you. Like, I didn't want to do this. I was just in Austin, Texas, building something that thought it was going to be killing the mainframe. Now you're telling me to go save the mainframe.
Oh gosh.
Being the problem solver that I am, yeah. I get my head around it. You know, and history was made. You know the story. I mean, we saved it. Yeah. We changed it. We changed the technology. We moved from bipolar to CMOS. I knew something about that. We moved the programming model internal to the system. We changed the way the system programming model worked, not the way the application model worked. The application model ran the same way. The systems model went from a closely coupled symmetric multiprocessor, which is like big uniprocessors and then put a lot of them together, but a lot can only be like 8, 16, versus the parallel model where you put hundreds, if not thousands of them to work. We switched it to the parallel model. We did all of that, transparent to our clients. That's why that product is still successful today. That's why it still exists today. The mainframe that began in 1964, and here we are in what, 2020? So what is that, 56 years later? 56 years later, that mainframe that exists today still runs the same code that was written in 1964. Unported, unrecompiled, unedited, unaltered. Pretty proud of that. I'm pretty proud. I mean, I didn't do it. I led it. I didn't do any of these things I'm telling you about. I just led the effort. I would have been blamed for them if they failed. That's typical. And they're good feelings for me. And then we got to know each other when I had to go to work. I went to work for Lou Gerstner, and we had to repair the IBM company, put it back together. We were wrong in everything we were doing. Our philosophy of development was wrong. You know, we had to change all of our processes, protocols, procedures, you know, save a lot of money, took our development budget from $10 billion to $6 billion overnight, and saved the company at the same time. And then went on to, you know, doing as much creative work as I could in the area of innovation, which again, ties back to you, you know, studying it. I'm very proud of the work we did for the Council on Competitiveness, the National Innovation Initiative, which the audience can still get off of the Council on Competitiveness's website, the NII, as I call it for short. It's my formula for innovation. I still use it. It's in my book. It's in every conversation and every talk I give on innovation. It's very simple, very basic. Start with the problem, understand it better than anyone else. You know, look for that deep hidden value, apply your unique thinking to it, do it in an open, collaborative, multidisciplined and global environment. Enable people to be their best, working collaboratively, cooperatively, and it all works. So Anita is my wife behind me. She's in the screen. I'm sorry about that. She's probably back here to do some work. Anita, wave to the people.
Hello.
Hi there.
Nice to meet you. I've heard a lot about you.
Yeah, there's more to learn too. She's back there copying. She's back there doing some copying work, I think. So, I mean, there's so many things to be proud of inside IBM, and I'm thankful for that opportunity. I truly am. I'm equally excited about, as you implied, the things I did after I left IBM. Right. So it's been an exciting 12 years for me. I meant graduated. Not retired. And I have been, you know, on a lot of boards, as you've already mentioned, AMD, the American Micro Devices. I was on their board up until a few years ago. We rebooted that company. That company is just, it's fighting like crazy now against Intel and Nvidia, but that company was on its deathbed, Rosemary, when I got there. Stock was about $1.50 a share. Stock's trading now somewhere in the 70s or the 80s. They just bought Xilinx, or they just merged with Xilinx. I'm blessed. Aptiv, car company, formerly Delphi Automotive. You know, Bank of New York became the Bank of New York Mellon, Liberty Mutual. Your organization, NACD, MITRE, and then several small companies that we're not even talking about. It's a thrill a minute for me. I keep my head in the game. I try to stay current, Rosemary. So I, as much as I'm proud of everything I did while I was at IBM, believe me, I am just as proud of the transformations at Aptiv, formerly Delphi Automotive, and AMD, as well as the contributions I made to the Bank of New York. I mean, you remember September 11th, unfortunately, that bank almost went upside down, because it was in the center of the ground zero, and its data centers were in the center of ground zero. We had to pull that bank up by its bootstraps, you know, and it's in the book. When the book comes out, Tom Rennie, who was the CEO and chairman, gives us a lot of credit for helping save that bank. Gives me, you know, that doesn't give it to me by myself, gives it to IBM for stepping in and helping save that bank. So, you know, being an engineer, problems are my business, as you know. I'd like to think that I've made my life not creating problems, but other people will judge that, but actually solving problems. That's what excites me, Rosemary.
You know what? I think it's very interesting, Nick. You have a distinct capability to also distinguish between something that's really a problem and something that's not really a problem. For example, I approached you the other couple of weeks ago, and I did the term on our board, and I was bouncing off this idea from you about taking or getting this EDA grant, and you have to get this 20% match, and how's the money going to come in? And you just kind of looked at it, and it could have been a problem, and you identified what could be a problem about it, but then you were like, oh, well, it's not going to be a big problem. Because you also parameterized it. It's really interesting how you dissect things and then learn more about them and then determine that, oh, it's really not a problem because you already solved it. It's amazing.
So I think to your point there, thank you for bringing that up. The point is, I think it's that engineering mindset that I have, you know, because engineers are problem solvers. They thrive on problems. And I think that's what you're pointing out. And I said that earlier in this discussion, I stopped long ago trying to solve problems I can't solve, right? I mean, so I keep looking for how to rearrange the problem, how to take it apart, you know, take big things, make them smaller things so that you can solve them one by one. If you can't solve it this big, solve something like this, 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 and this. And it seems to have worked out for me, Rosemarie. And it's not just to my points that I made with the companies I was involved in, it was with you, it's with everybody. And the other thing I think that's critically important, you want to be innovative, you want to rock, you got to keep learning. I mean, the world is moving at an amazingly fast pace. I mean, you talk about the gradients back in 1962, 63, 64, 65. I think the gradients are higher now. Mm-hmm. I think the rate of change is increasing. You've heard me say this before, you know, pick your favorite order of magnitude in terms of things big and things small. Yeah. You know, I mean, we're headed to a world of yada and yakta. Yada, 10 to the 24th. Yakto, 10 to the minus 24th. I mean, those are real, honest to God, you know, national standards, international standard words and orders of magnitude. And I mean, it's mind-boggling for people to say, well, you know, I think, you know, tera's a lot, giga's a lot, mega's a lot, petta's a lot. No, I tell you, it's a long way to go, but we're going to get to the 10 to the 24th big, 10 to the minus 24th small. That's where the world is going. And then beyond that, we'll come up with some new names. I'm sure better than me are thinking about new names.
I think for your book, you should create some more names.
Some new names. Okay. All right. So, I mean,
the world a challenge.
But I think my point here is, you know, that's where the opportunity lies for people, you know, to keep learning, whether you're learning in life science or physical science or political science, or educational science or philosophical science or religious science. I don't care. I mean, I think there's science associated with all of them. I think everything is turning. This is the decade of life science. We know that, decade. It's the century of life science. It's supported by physical science. It's hard to get to the life science results we're getting to if the computers hadn't made the progress that the computers made. So, I mean, I do think that all of us have to continue to remind ourselves that it's all about lifelong learning. I hated biology. I never took it. I took earth science when I was in high school. You know, my daughter's a life scientist. She taught me so much about life science. And I'm not saying I'm any good at this, but, you know, among the other boards that we didn't mention, I'm on the board of the New York Genome Center. I mean, it's a high-tech life science company. But it's all about data. It's all about computation. It's all about modeling and simulation. So, I mean, I think the world has to kind of remind itself what you know is not what's going to determine your success. In fact, I like to say it this way. We will be judged more by what we do about what we don't know than what we know. Because there's always something more to be known.
I think you have a famous quote, what can be known will be known.
Ah, that's the other one. So here's the way that works out. Yeah, you're pointing to some good quotes here. I like to say that everything known is knowable.
No, always
has been knowable, but the time to knowledge is shrinking because of technology. So it's hard and harder for you to live in a world of lies, because those lies are going to become unearthed and they're going to become known and the truth is going to become known. I mean, we could do a whole session on social media and the impact of social media and alternative theories and conspiracy theories and alternative worlds and, you know, contrary perspectives and how social media can ruin your life. You know, if you're not careful, right in front of your eyes by lies that people tell about you. So I think the good news is we're on the cusp of turning technology around and giving you, the individual, more control over your privacy. Just as we have, you know, hearkened on this issue of security from a cyber perspective, that whole thing can be flipped around and we can give you more control of your privacy with the same, almost the same set of technologies. And I see more and more new startups, more and more new ideas, more and more new money being invested, you know, in this side of it. Wouldn't be surprised if someday soon, you know, just like we have a fintech and we have an HR tech and we have a, you know, a cyber tech, we'll have a privacy tech, you know, segment of the investment market, Rosemary. You know, and maybe some of those technologies, you know, you and the organization, CAI, will be able to unearth, you know, and bring to life.
We actually have found some really interesting privacy tech inventions that we're thinking about working with Peace Tech Labs on a challenge around. You know, because of their ability to use artificial intelligence to identify hate speech in different areas. And the challenge, you know, with the privacy tech also, though, is it could prevent perhaps the opportunity to find some of the hate speech. So it's like this interesting balance.
There's a ditch on both sides of the road, as you know. There always has been, there always will be. Yeah. And we do have to think more about what we do in the sense of the consequences of our actions. So I'll make a general statement, and it's certainly arguable. I don't think we ever sit down and invent something to be bad. That's not what we do. We sit down, we try to create something to create value. And then what happens is the lazy people, the crooks are lazy people. They look for ways to transform that. They look for ways to literally shape that or reshape that into an easier way for them to make a living, to make money. And, you know, we need to do a better job of thinking like that. We need to do a better job of owning the responsibility and the risks of unleashing new technology to think about the adverse consequences. We don't do enough of that, Rosemary. I mean, I actually remember being taught one of these courses when I was at RPI, you know, the morals and ethics of technology course. I mean, we need to go deeper on that. Each and every one of us, you know, Facebook should go deeper on it. Twitter should go deeper on it. Every one of the social media companies should go deeper on it. And unless and until perhaps you have been abused, and I was abused, as you know, earlier this year, you know, on social media. I think it's hard to make the case because most people say, that's not the way it works. You know, it's not that bad. It's not that bad until it's terrible is the problem.
I know. I don't know. Did I tell you the story about what happened to me?
I don't believe so.
Oh, someone took all my pictures and videos off the internet and they altered them. And then they started texting me them.
Yeah.
And told me, you know, this is going to be all over every single social media handle.
Yep.
If you don't give me, dollars. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's insane that somebody could do that. So I just put a post on LinkedIn and I said, if you see any you know, crazy pictures of me, it's not really me. So and videos, it means it's not. Got prepared to.
The good news is we could probably detect that those were documented or they were touched up, that they were changed. You know, in my case, the person actually wrote a story, created a storyline, and was just trying to totally discredit me and actually get me fired. They were also trying to get me arrested by the U.S.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they were trying to get me arrested, you know, stating that I had violated my security clearance, that I was working with the Chinese, that the whole Huawei issue was my fault.
Oh, my gosh.
That I had contrived it. I had conceived it, and that it was my fault that Huawei was the leader in 5G. And I'm part of a secret plot. So it gets worse. I mean, it gets pretty bad, and it doesn't cost you a lot of money to do this.
I know.
Turns out for a couple hundred bucks, you know, you could write these stories, fabricate these stories, post these stories, and then all you need to do is to get one or two idiots on Twitter to pick up a feed, you know, and then start to push this, you know. And this person, we actually knew who the person was, and we knew why the person was doing it, although we couldn't prove that. But we did squash it all. We crushed it, to be honest with you. But I mean, I don't know that everybody can do that. I was in a better position to crush it than other people who just say, well, you know, it'll go away by itself. But it doesn't, you know, this stuff lives forever, as you know, on the web.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm glad that you got that taken care of.
Yeah, it was a tough couple of months, though, I'll tell you. It was gut-wrenching because I couldn't get my hands on it and, you know, just squeeze it and fix it and take it apart and look at it and make it happen. But I was pleased with the end result, to be honest with you. We, in an orderly fashion, and we're talking more about this, and we're going to do something a little bit more deliberate, I think, on this topic as well. I don't know whether I'll write another aftermath to my book or what, but, and by the way, I think there's something on, it's either Amazon or Netflix called The Social Dilemma. I mean, I highly recommend you take a look at that. I mean, I lived through that social dilemma.
Wow. So, you know, we started a company called Ignite Social Impact. Mm-hmm. It's a crowd equity platform. I'm just thinking about what else we should be putting on that platform to raise money, privacy tech and some things to prevent this horrible social media shenanigans that happen.
I think it's worthwhile to think that way, and, you know, take a look at The Social Dilemma. You know, there's more and more people talking about this now, and that gets back to this privacy thing. We need to find ways to help you defend yourself or validate yourself or authenticate yourself. You know, this way it's easier. Well, those are not my pictures, Rosemary mm-hmm. Truman says. Mm-hmm. You know, there is nothing authentic about those pictures. Or that's not my story, Nick D'Onofrio says. There's nothing authentic about that story. It's totally fabricated. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you start to push more and more of that technology capability, and then where these things go should be ashamed of themselves, because they are now posting something that's not true to you. It's not authenticated by Rosemary Truman, or it's not authenticated by Nick D'Onofrio. So those companies should become at risk and liable.
Right.
For posting something that's not authentic to you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, recently, so I was working with a girlfriend of mine. She's working on this grant around suicide prevention. And we were going through all the numbers, and very recent numbers that just came off out of some studies. The suicide rates have gone up for children by 27% from last year. Mm-hmm. And the bullying rate and the sexting rates are off the charts from last year. So this is just, I mean, the dilemma is bigger with all of the dynamics that we have going on right now. And I mean, the impact that kids have as a result of social distancing and staying at home and working, you know, doing their schoolwork. I think that there's gonna be a lasting impact. So it's very timely to have this social dilemma. And I think you probably should write another book, because there's going to be, you know, the problem is only exasperated by what's going on.
I think you're right, Rosemary. I think there was a lot of unknowns here and a lot of adverse consequences that, you know, will come to light. You know, we see this with people who are in the service. You know, they seem to have a successful career in the service, but then they have this post-traumatic stress, you know, syndrome. Things like that are going to show up here as a result of COVID-19. I'm very hopeful we're going to get this under control. I mean, you know, I take a longer term view than most people. I think it's going to take us till June of next year to have really gotten this thing under control. We'll be closer to a vaccine. We'll have more instantaneous testing, more reliable instantaneous testing, you know, so we can start to feel more comfortable about what we do, where we go, when we go, and why we go. So, and we'll know a lot more about it, because every day we seem to be learning more about this crazy, you know, virus, which mutates, you know, so readily and could cause lots of other things that we don't know about that years from now we will know about. So, but I'm a science guy. You can tell that I'm an engineer. You know, I love math and science, and I have great respect for nature. You know, I don't want to screw around with it. You know, I want to fix it in the time I have left. I was just looking at buying a new Ferrari, electric Ferrari, by the way. So,
oh wow!
I don't know that I have a big enough bank account for that. It's a very expensive car, but it's, you know, a Bentley just made an announcement today that by 2030 they're only going to be making electric cars.
Wow!
All the gas and oil Bentleys will be gone. I think all of us know that's coming, and that's going to be a foredrawn conclusion. And I guess this is how right I was back in 1960.
Yes, I was about to
say. Everything is electric. You know? Everything is electric.
Electric engineer.
Like, wow, how right could you be? So, you know, I have a Tesla. I love it. I have a hybrid. I love it. I've gas and oil, you know, a small gas and oil collection as well. But, you know, I do think it's not only better, electricity isn't only better for us and for the environment. To be totally upfront with you, Rosemary, it's actually more fun.
Oh, okay.
I mean, my Tesla is just a minute kind of a car. You know, so nobody says you have to go back to the dark ages to make advancements, to do things better, to make the world greener, safer, better. Nobody's saying that you have to go backwards to do that. It's actually going to be better if you do that. I can give you alternative scenarios that, you know, technology can evolve for us and we can be so much better served and so much better off, so much happier, you know, so much more comfortable, you know, cooler in the summer, warmer in the winter. You know, there's all kinds of benefits of technology. If you but listen to the innovators, right? So you look at the problem, start with the problem, not the answer, and then work back. Everything can be better. And I know you know that. I mean, that's what our organization, the Center for Advancing Innovation, is all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what we got to keep looking for. We're pretty, as you know, you're more focused, the center is more focused in life sciences right now, but that doesn't mean that there aren't, and you did spend time yourself, you know, in the Department of Energy out on the West Coast, with one of the labs out there. I mean, there's so much more to be done
in the
area of energy.
Yeah.
So many brilliant ideas out there waiting to bust through. So I get excited about all of this, Rosemary. Even at 75, I'm very excited about the possibilities for a much better future for all of us. For all of us.
Not
just some of us, but all of us.
What's really exciting is, you know, we just wrapped up the SCALE challenge, the Supply Chain and Logistics Enterprises challenge. Yep. And the technology that came out of that is just, it's outrageous. Really exciting with the next generation AR and VR in the supply chain. Mm-hmm. And the integration of all of the different new cutting edge, bleeding edge technology that can really dramatically transform every supply chain.
Absolutely.
Food supply, it's challenge. It was one of our best cohorts ever. Just it tickled me.
I think that's great. So I think that's another important lesson, what you just said, is innovation can happen everywhere. You know, you think of something, to your point, like a supply chain, what can you do with a supply chain? Supply chain is a supply chain. Or delivery. You know, you can go through the whole process of, you know, how value is created, the whole, you know, value chain.
Mm-hmm.
They all can be, you know, we're innovating in sales, we're innovating in marketing. Of course, you can innovate in delivery and you can innovate in supply chain. You can innovate in manufacturing, you're innovating in development. So let's not let people get stuck on the fact that the only people who can innovate are people who invent.
I mean,
inventions aren't always innovations.
Absolutely.
You know that. I mean, just because there's an invention doesn't mean there's an innovation. In fact, many of the things that you stand for is that's what's wrong with that invention is it didn't do anything. You know, it never yielded. So let's put it in the hands of somebody where it might be able to yield. Let's do something more important with it and let's solve a different problem with it. So I and you know me from my time at IBM, I think it was very important that I got the head of IBM engaged into this whole idea that everybody can be an innovator. Not everybody can be an inventor. Not everybody can be a creator, but everybody can be an innovator. You can innovate everywhere across the entire ecosystem and value chain. And if you have that attitude, you know, nothing can stop you. Everything, I mean, I review a dozen proposals a week, a dozen startup proposals a week. I'm just amazed that there's a dozen every week. You know, that when does it stop? It doesn't. There's a lot of very innovative, clever people out there. And like I said, you know, we're moving from fintech to cyber tech to HR tech to put your thing in front of tech and call it a tech. I mean, you know what I mean, right?
Yeah. For South by Southwest, one of the proposals we made was innovate tech.
That's fine with me.
Innovation.
Yeah. Maybe we should have a political tech too. Maybe we should have a government tech, or maybe we should have an education tech. I mean, there's a lot going on in education, and there is a lot of money being spent on innovative technologies. But, you know, to your point, this whole COVID world, like what you and I are doing now, this whole virtual thing that's arrived, I mean, you have to kind of step back from this and you say to yourself, look, you know what this means to me? It means that things are no longer one or the other, that there is now a spectrum of opportunity. We have the physical world over here, the virtual world over here, but we have everything in the middle. So they're no longer simply one or the other. It's no longer digital, on or off. And so much is going on in our lives where the on or off thought is finally realizing that there's a spectrum, there's a continuum. Gender is another one. You know, that it's a spectrum. It's no longer simply you're this or you're that. And yeah. Put religion aside, put whatever your personal beliefs aside, it's a fact. I mean, and we're going to learn, honest to God, we're going to learn the facts of life as we study life sciences, and we're going to find out what's going on here. And you're going to find out that there's real reasons for this, that this isn't I might upset a lot of your audience, and I apologize for that, but you're going to find out that it's not simply choice. It's not simply choice. It's who we are. I mean, I hear more and more young people, you say, well, you just had a baby. What is it? And they say, well, we'll know by the time they're 16. You know, we'll know by the time. I mean, if you want to be realistic about it, that's probably a right thought. You'll know later. Now that upsets people. You know, you got to understand what's happening. You have to understand where the world is going. You have to understand all of these complicated situations and then try to put them into a perspective and then rationalize them in your own life. Because if you don't, they'll overwhelm you. Mm-hmm. And that's what innovators don't let happen to them. I mean, you know, I knew Steve Jobs very well. We were friends for many, many years, he and I. I mean, so I have a lot of insight into what his insights were and how he did what he did. You know, God rest his soul. You know, he wasn't the smartest person in the world, but boy, could he ever see a problem, Rosemary. He could understand it better than, and he didn't care how fast it was. He didn't care where things were. He didn't care who was moving at what speed. He was going to move at his own speed. And he was going to solve that problem in a unique way. The whole notion of the iPod, which started everything, it put Apple on a whole new curve. I think everyone would agree to that. The iPod did it. What is the iPod? Where did it come from? What? I mean, it came from other people's failures. It came from Napster's failure.
Yep.
He studied that. He studied that to a fare thee well. He studied every MP3 player to a fare thee well. I mean, so he puts together a couple of pieces of plastic, a little hard drive, two chips inside, gets a clever little interface. I mean, I still have the original iPod, you know, downstairs in my bag. I take it with me wherever I go. It's like there isn't an invention in there. There isn't one invention in there. But boy, is it ever innovative?
Yeah.
Not? I mean, the truth of the matter is he rocked the world with that. And then from that iPod, what? Name it, iPad, iPhone, you know, how bright was he?
Yeah.
But he started with the problem right in front of your eyes. Everybody knew what the problem was, right? Everybody could see it. You know, it wasn't like a secret problem. Napster was being sued, Napster was in trouble. You know, the MP3 players were, you know, okay, maybe I like them, I don't like them. But that, I mean, Steve was just a very gifted person that way. He just mastered the problem, understood the problem, and he worked back from the problem to get the answer. That's what we all should do. We should all be that way. We should all button up until we understand the problem well enough and then dig in, get as much data as we can, and go from there. I'm sorry, am I talking too much?
No, it's fantastic. I have like 1,000 questions for you. Oh
boy. And we only have what, 20 minutes, 10 minutes left. So.
Yeah, 10 minutes left. Where do I start? It was really interesting just talking about the iPad. You know, I analyzed that market for one of my strategy gigs, and it was called the mobile jukebox market, if you could imagine that, yeah. Right? And technically, there were all of these mobile jukeboxes that were superior in terms of different things, you know,
sure.
Battery life. And yet he came out with the iPod that everybody mm-hmm. loved because the user experience, because he analyzed every single part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And you know, I coined a term called insight analysis for that, because he thought about the business model, he thought about the customer, you know, the voice of the customer, the yep. technical quality, just every single category, you know, like 8 different categories, he just took, dissected, and put it back together, and yep. came out with this very clean, well thought through, every single part about it.
Yep, and it was foretelling. I mean, I don't think we should forget that it was foretelling. I mean, remember the iPod couldn't be taken apart. I mean, it was the beginning of the devices that you can't fix. You can't fix by yourself. I mean, you know, the first thing I do is look, where are the screws? You know, like, yeah. Can I get inside this thing? There weren't any. John Rubinstein is still a very good friend of mine. He went to work for Steve, and he actually designed the iPod. So he's actually the product designer for the iPod. I mean, with Steve's influence, of course. John's a wonderful guy. We're still connected. So I give them a tremendous amount of respect for not only Rosemarie, not only making a market. So they I won't say they created the market, because the market, to your point, was there. You, as you appropriately said, you analyzed it and we all saw it, but they made the market be what
they made it be what they wanted it to be.
Made the market for themselves. Out of that vast array of, you know, Napster, MP3 players, you know, Sony had one, everybody had 1, 2, 3. And he comes in with this thing called the iPod, and how fortuitous and foretelling is it? It becomes the I world, and it starts to tell you, you know, your device is now sealed. You know, I don't want you touching it. You know, if you need to do anything with it, you have to come to me or buy a new one. So, I mean, you have to give the guy was a genius. I mean, got to give him a lot of credit for the way he could understand. And we used to talk about this all the time. You know, when he first went back to Apple, he wanted me to go work with him. Fortunately, I couldn't. It was unfortunate for me. I couldn't. Maybe I should have, for all I know. Had a lot of other things going on here from a health perspective, so I couldn't go with my wife. You know, he worked hard to bring the company back. If you remember, he was at Next, you know, they fired him. You know, he went to Next, did a reasonable job, not a great job, but did a reasonable job. And then when they wanted him to come back, you have to remember he made Apple buy Next. So the Next wasn't a failure. He made them buy Next. And took no money, you know, only took stock, and, you know, knew how rich he was going to be because he was going to make it work. And when he went back to Apple, I don't know if you remember this, but they still had no color. They had they had only black and white displays. The first color I remember this big announcement of color. It wasn't color displays. It was the color of the display.
Oh my gosh.
Remember those bubble things, you know, those tube things? Well, yeah, you can have a blue one, you can have a red one, you can have a green one, you can have a white one, you can have a pink one, you know. And then finally, they got in control of color, you know, and they put all of the shades of gray, which was amazing. They could do amazing things with shades of gray at Apple. You know, they put that capability into real color. And, you know, I remember Steve telling me, Nick, we'll do real color when real color is ready and not before. Lovely. You know, what do I know? Apparently, you know what you're talking about. And he did. So, you know, those are innovators, Rosemary. Those are the kind of people that we should aspire to be. And Steve's a very good example of what I mean. You start with the problem, you understand the problem, you work the problem, you live with the problem, you then try to figure out where that hidden value is and then how to go at it. So I'm pretty much overstaying my welcome here. So I'm sorry, Rosemary, if we didn't do what you wanted to do.
This is perfect, Nick. It's wonderful. You know, there's a couple more things I'd like to talk about quickly. You know, you were on the board of this company. I was trying to remember the name of it. It was like a hackathon company, and it was purchased.
I'm not sure. I don't remember what you're talking about.
Okay.
So I am on the board of several companies, but
yes, I know
it hasn't been purchased, and I don't want to disclose any names right now. So I'll demur.
Okay.
Do that.
All right.
Yeah, so, sorry about that.
That's all right. So what are some final words of wisdom that you would like to leave people with? You've given everybody many, many valuable insights, like start with the problem.
Sure.
Everybody can be an innovator. There's many, you know, look at the social dilemma, read the
right.
social dilemma.
Right.
Be a lifelong learner.
Yeah.
I loved what you said before about when you have a problem, take the problem and start to parse it into pieces. And then I used to call that shrink and destroy.
You were actually pretty good at that. I remember we had huge problems when you and I worked together. I think the other advice I'd give you, especially in this moment in time, you have to always have the courage of your convictions and act against those convictions. Stand up for what's right. Stand up to be on the right side of history. Understand what the right side of history is. Think about it, consider it, and then go to it with the courage of your convictions. You know, in a world like you said, where everything known is knowable and always will be, and the time to knowledge is shrinking, you know, we have to worry more about, are we doing the right thing? Leaders need to be aspirational. They need to be inspirational and perspirational. I learned that very early on in my career. You have to have an aspirational view, and then you have to be able to inspire your team to get there, but don't fool yourself. You have to work as hard, if not harder than them, in order to get the job done. So I leave those closing thoughts with everyone. You know, I think our better days are still ahead of us. I am a technologist at heart. I am an engineer at heart. Don't ever give up. In the famous words of Winston Churchill in the darkest hours in World War II, to his constituents in Europe, don't ever give up. Don't ever give up. Don't ever give up. And I think we should not do that. Don't ever give up on the environment. Let's not give up on each other. Let's not give up on ourselves. Let's not give up on our systems. You know, there's more value to be created. We'll get through this coronavirus together. Together, you know, I'll respect you. You respect me. And we can make a much better world for all of us, not just some of us, for all of us. And we have to start thinking more like that, Rosemary. How do we move opportunity to talent? You know, talent is equally distributed among us. Whether you like it or not, the facts are such that talent is equally distributed among all of us, regardless of our race, our gender, our color, our creed, our geography. What's not equally distributed is opportunity. And we have to find a way to continue to distribute that opportunity equally. And I'll leave that sober thought with you.
Thank you very much, Nick.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
Fantastic. Very valuable insights. And I have to introduce you to Maurice Jones, who I just did a podcast with. He's the president of an organization called LISC, L-I-S-C. Uh-huh. And he said those words in a completely different way. And you guys could have a mind meld, really. Yeah. So I'm going to introduce you. Anyway, thank you so much.
I look forward to that. Thank you. All the best to you. Stay well, stay safe, and always be nice.
I will.
I know you will. Thank you. Peace. Bye-bye. Ciao.